Okay, the Arizal. Here's our second installment of the Legends and Lessons. Legends and Lessons are really one of my favorite classes to give because you really learn a lot. You learn a lot because not only is it information you don't know, but it's also information that you feel like you should know. Right? We've all heard the name the Arizal. We've heard it this time or that time. Oh yeah, it comes from the Arizal. Oh, it's a minhag from the Arizal. But who is this guy? Who's the Arizal? So let's think about it for a second and try to understand who he was, and then we'll get into some of the things that maybe you're familiar with from the Arizal. The Arizal was born to a man named Rabbi Shlomo Luria. Maybe he wasn't a rabbi, I'm actually not sure. But he might have had a distant cousin named Rabbi Shlomo Luria, who was very well known. And his more known acronym is the Maharshal. It happens to be that he's... Some say they're probably not related. If they were related, it was distant, because there are no clear connections. But his last name was Luria, and his father's name was Shlomo. And when it comes to Shlomo Luria, Shlomo Luria lived in a town called Brisk. Not the Brisk that you think of. Different Brisk, also in Western Europe, but not the same one, apparently. Again, I'm not an expert on history, so you'd have to ask other people if you want to get really into the details. But basically what happens is that soon before, like a little bit before the Arizal was born, so Shlomo and his family move because of persecution. In Brisk, there were new taxes. As you can imagine, we're talking about the early 16th century. So the early 16th century is right at the aftermath of what formative... No, not yet. We'll get to that later, but that's later. What happens at the end of the 15th century in the Jewish world? The
Inquisition.
Right, Inquisition, the expulsion, right? So 1492, there's a lot of shifting, a lot of transition for the Jewish people. And part of the repercussions of those transitions happen in different places, different times. So obviously in Spain, there was a very big mass of Jewish people that left and went different places. But even other places, Portugal and other surrounding areas also had after effects. So there was more persecution even in Brisk. And Shlomo Luria moves the family to none other than Jerusalem, to Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim did not have a lot of people there, a lot of Jews there. There's only one shul. Anyone know what shul that was? What shul has always existed in Yerushalayim, at least for a long time?
The
Chorva? The Chorva is a good guess, but no, that was destroyed and had some ups and downs.
The Ramban shul.
The Ramban, when he comes to Yerushalayim at the end of his life, when did the Ramban live? 1194 to 1270, something like that. So when he comes over to Eretz Yisrael in the 1260s or whatever it was, so he settles in Yerushalayim and he sets up a shul, and it's now called the Ramban Shul. I don't know if the one that we have today is the same Ramban Shul. They say it is.
Ramban.
The Rambam allegedly never made it to Eretz Yisrael.
Oh, so it's Ramban.
But the Ramban went to Eretz Yisrael. And there are interesting commentaries in the parish of the Ramban about how he went to Eretz Yisrael, and there's a machlokas about where Kever Rachel is. I don't know if anyone's familiar with this. Nowadays, everyone thinks it's the same place. Yeah. But it used to be the Rishonim argued about where Kever Rachel is, and there's a big machlokas Rishonim on the Torah, on the Pesukim. And the Ramban says in his parish, the Ramban famously has different versions of his parish on the Chumash, and in his second version he says, now that I've had the opportunity to come to the land of Israel, I can safely say that Kever Rachel is right here. I've been there, that's where it is. And he agrees with Rashi, gives proofs to Rashi's understanding.
Is that the one near Efrat?
Near Efrat? I don't think so. Beit Lechem, yeah. Near Hebron, maybe. But when it comes to the Ramban Shul, so he settles that in Yerushalayim, there are very, very few Jews there. Happens to be, at this point in history, in the 1520s, so there was a significant mass of Jews there that had come over from Spain. So there were some Jews already in Yerushalayim at this point, not tons, a few hundred families, which, you know, nowadays is nothing, but back then was something. A few hundred families, and they would daven in the Ramban Shul. So Shlomo Luria takes the family there. And because of that, his child, the Arizal, ends up being born there, right? His name is Yitzchak. Yitzchak is the name of the Arizal. We'll get into how exactly he has the name Arizal in a second. But how was he born? There are many legends, especially about the Arizal. When it comes to any mystic figure, you're always going to have legends. And I can't tell you one way or the other in terms of the accuracy. But the story goes that Eliyahu HaNavi comes to Shlomo Luria and he says to him, you're going to have a son who is going to be the light unto to the Jewish people. And sure enough, he has a son. But Eliyahu HaNavi tells him, don't give him a bris until I get there. Okay, it's an interesting statement. But basically they set up a bris the eighth day of who's going to be the Arizal. And the bris, they schedule it in the morning, and Eliyahu HaNavi's not there, and he's not there, and he's still not there, and people are just leaving. And it comes only in the afternoon, Eliyahu HaNavi shows up, Shlomo sees him, and says to them all, okay, it's time to go, now we can have the bris. Eliyahu HaNavi comes to him afterwards and says, I was testing you to see your commitment. I don't know if it was, if the success of the Arizal was totally on this commitment or not, but either way, that's the story about the Arizal's birth and his bris. Slowly but surely, as you can imagine,
is that the source of why we have a Kisei Shel Eliyahu?
That's not the source of it, but it might corroborate that. I don't think that's the source of it. I don't remember the source of it, but I don't think that's it. So when it comes to the upbringing of the Arizal, as you can imagine, little Yitzchak, little Isaac, whatever you want to call him, was very prestigious, prodigious is the word I was looking for. And he's learning and learning and learning. He's mastering Shas, as you can imagine. What happens at his when he's 8 years old, some people don't know exactly what the date is, some people say it's 8 years old. 8 years old, his father dies. Shlomo dies from some plague. Might have been the Black Death, we're not sure. But he dies, and the mother basically has to figure out what she's going to do with Yitzchak. Happens to be the mother had a wealthy brother. His name was Mordechai Francis. He was from France. That's why his name was Francis. Back then, it wasn't so common that that Jews had last names, or people had last names in general. Ashkenazim had more last names than Sephardim. But that's why you have Luria, which was also a fairly new last name for the Luria family. Luria was the name of a river in Germany. But this Francis, his name was Francis because he came from France. Which means also that he was probably Ashkenazic, which is interesting because I think the Arizal's mother was Sephardi. So he's what do you call that? A mixed marriage. A mixed marriage, yeah.
Francis Scott Key.
No? Yeah, different person.
No, the Francis.
Yeah, I don't know if they're related, but if the etymology is related even. But when it comes to Mordechai Francis, so he was a very wealthy man. How was he wealthy? First of all, he lived in Cairo. So a different situation, especially economically. He was what they called a tax farmer. Anyone know what a tax farmer is? He was the middleman, right? As Dr. Henry Abramson, also a Jewish historian, points out, the Jews were oftentimes used as the tax farmers because they were always a minority. They were always good at it. And they were always safe in that they wouldn't be abused by the majority. And they also wouldn't, you know, be abused by the kings and the queens, whatever. They were the ones to go to the people and get taxes on behalf of the government. So this Mordechai Francis was one of the tax farmers for the government, the Ottoman Empire. And I don't know if it was the Ottoman Empire or the people, the local Cairo government, but he was the tax farmer. And he offered his sister and Yitzchak to come and stay by him, and ultimately gives his daughter to Yitzchak to marry. So the Arizal marries his uncle/father, right? He marries the daughter of now his uncle/father-in-law, and they're being supported by his business, but it turns out that in the early years of his marriage, the Arizal wasn't entirely supported by his father-in-law. Fascinatingly, we only learned this a few decades ago with the uncovering of the Cairo Geniza. In the Cairo Geniza, which has, you know, hundreds of thousands of documents that teach us a lot about Jewish history, that we still have yet to uncover all of it. But in the Cairo Geniza, we have many papers that are from the Arizal. Not many, but we have a few very important ones. Some of them are receipts of the Arizal's selling. He used to sell peppers and he used to sell leather. And we have the receipts, the invoices of all of those sales, not all of them, but some of them. And we know the Arizal was a businessman. Probably was early on in his marriage, as we'll see why in a second. We have that, and then we have other things that we'll talk about soon. So he had this wealthy father-in-law, but he was still working It's a good muster for some people that just because you have a wealthy father-in-law doesn't mean you can sit around and do nothing. But when it comes to the Arizal, so he has his wife and he has some children. But soon he figures out that he actually he wants to learn full time. And how this comes to be, there's a whole debate as to when what happens. But I'll start here. When he gets to Cairo, and he gets to Egypt, so he connects himself to a very important rabbi. His name was the Radvaz, Reb David ibn Zimra. Anyone heard of the Radvaz before? The Radvaz was a giant in halacha, but he was also a giant in Kabbalah. What that means, we'll get to soon. But the Radvaz was actually in Spain, and he was himself expelled from Spain. He ends up going to Yerushalayim, he goes to other places in Eretz Yisrael, I think, and ends up going to Cairo to become what is then called the chief rabbi, which before was called the Nagid, and now the chief rabbi. He basically takes over the position of the Rambam. The Rambam was the chief rabbi of Cairo, right? For much of his life, after he had to leave Spain because of his own persecution. So he became the chief rabbi for many years, as in addition to being the physician of the Sultan at the time. The Radvaz didn't have the medical background, but he had the rabbinic background, so he was the chief rabbi of Cairo. And the Arizal starts to learn by the Radvaz. Now, when he's learning by the Radvaz, he's not learning Kabbalah. He's learning Gemara. He's learning your typical stuff, things that normal kids would learn at that point. And at one point, I'll tell you the version through a legend. At some point, the Arizal starts to take an interest in Kabbalah. It's not clear when, it's not clear how, but there is the following story. People are familiar with Fiddler on the Roof.
Sure.
So we know perhaps my favorite part of Fiddler on the Roof is "If I Were a Rich Man," because of all the little innuendos that he has inside the song. So in one line he says in there, "If I were rich, I would sit by the eastern wall." You know that phrase? Mm-hmm. "I'd sit by the eastern wall and I'd daven and I'd learn all day, blah, blah, blah." So it happens to be that the Arizal, even though his father-in-law was wealthy, preferred to stand in the back of the shul on the western wall to daven with the poorer people, right? With the paupers. So it comes one time, there's a visitor into town, yeah.
In Cairo, the shul wouldn't have been facing east.
I guess that's true, whatever it was, I don't know. But the legend has it that he was with the poor people in the back of the shul. Maybe it wasn't, maybe you're right, that's a good point. No, Cairo. I guess it would
like
be.
Northeast.
It would be like northeast. I don't know. We'd have to confirm one way or another. But either way, so the Arizal is sitting in the back of the shul, and this visitor comes in. A visitor comes in, and he's clearly trying to daven, but he's lost. He doesn't know what's going on, and I don't know if the Arizal approached him or he approached the Arizal. They had siddurim, and this guy was using a siddur. 16th century, there were some siddurim, especially for the basic stuff. And he goes over to the Arizal and says, "Can you help me figure out, you know, how to daven?" So one leads to another. The guy was from Spain, and he was what some people call the Marano. And the Maranos, even though they were Jewish and they tried to keep their Judaism, oftentimes lost many of the traditions because they weren't allowed to publicly serve Hashem, you know, out in the open, so they had to do everything privately. And because of that, they lost many of their traditions, and this guy didn't really know how to daven. So the Arizal said to him, "You know, you have your own siddur." He brought his own siddur from his grandparents or something, and it was old and it had other things in it. And the Arizal's looking through it, and he says, "You know, why don't you just use one of our siddurs that we'll use, and you'll stay on the same page, right?" And he doesn't daven very well, but at least he'll be on the same page. After davening, the Arizal takes a look at this siddur. And this is not your normal siddur. It's a siddur which not only has davening, but also has commentary from the Zohar. And the Arizal says to the guy, "The stuff in here is unbelievable. Can I please have it?" And this guy is, you know, a merchant. He doesn't have much from his Jewish background. He says to him, "I don't really want to give it up. You know, this is my grandparent, whatever." The Arizal said, "Please, I'll give you whatever you want." Obviously, the Arizal might have been gambling with someone else's money at that point, i.e. his father-in-law's. But either way, he says to him, "I'll give you whatever you want." And the guy says, "You know what? I'm a wealthy merchant, and I have a lot of goods here. If you set me up with your father-in-law, we can do business together, I'll give you the siddur." And that's what happens, and the Arizal takes the siddur, he starts to look at it, and he sees that it's the Zohar, it's Kabbalah. This is all legend. I can't confirm or deny, but this is brought down. And it's brought down in the art scroll biography of the Arizal. So take or leave it. And the Arizal then goes to the Radvaz. He says, Rabbi, can I start learning Kabbalah? Now, how old was the Arizal at this point? Not very old, in his early 20s. But at that time, he had already gained a certain traction among the other rabbis in the community. And the Radvaz says to him, this is what the Radvaz says. He says, you can learn Kabbalah once you improve on your midos. That's what he says to him. So I don't exactly know which midah was what, whatever. But so who does he turn to be his... We said last week in the Pshischa and the Parsha class that everybody should have a Rebbe for their midos. Whether it's someone who's smicha or not smicha. So you're struggling with a midah, find someone who's good at those midos, and they can be your Rebbe. And so the Arizal finds a man by the name of Rav Betzalel Ashkenazi. Anyone know who Rav Betzalel Ashkenazi was? He was also a very prominent rabbi, writer. He authored a book called the Shita Mekubetzes. Shita Mekubetzes is a Rishon or a compilation of Rishonim on Shas. And the Arizal also, you know, was living near him also. He says, can you help me get better, you know, in my personality, in my midos, my character traits? So one thing leads to another, and ultimately the Arizal is able, gets the go-ahead from the Radvaz that he can start learning Kabbalah. And this was the beginning of the end, you know, the rest of the Arizal's life. But what does the Arizal do? So first of all, it should be noted that the Arizal, as I said before, was part of this group of rabbis. And we found in the Kairo Geniza, we have this document that says on it that there was a secret club of rabbis in Cairo, which included these three and others. And they had these little, and this is known to have existed in other places too, especially in Sfat, which we'll see soon. But there's a list of nine rabbis, and they all took a pact together that they said that we're going to meet together and we're going to make each other, you know, we're going to help each other, encourage each other to be better people. And they had a little rule in there, which is that if you see something that someone else does that you think is inappropriate, you have to tell them within 24 hours. That's what they said. You have to tell them within 24 hours. And if you don't tell them within 24 hours, you have to tell them eventually. And then whenever you tell them and apologize to them for not telling them, that person has to then say, I forgive you. This was one of the rules on the sheet, just to show you what kind of group this was. So he was part of this group, and he was only in his younger 20s. And he was already in this illustrious group of rabbis. But then something changes. When he gets into this thing with the Kabbalah, so what happens is he wants to study it alone. And when I say alone, I mean mamish alone. If you look at your paper, so the bottom right picture, you'll see what looks like a river. I think on the right side is Cairo. On the left side is an island. It's a small island, and it's very close by to Cairo. And it's separated by this little river. What's the island called? The island nowadays in English is called the Roda Island, but in Arabic it was Jazarit al-Rawda. I don't know if that's the best pronunciation or not, but Jazarit al-Rawda was this place where the Arizal would go. It wasn't a 9-to-5 thing. He went Motzei Shabbos, he went to this island, and he stayed there until Friday afternoon. The whole week, by himself, learning Kabbalah. This is what the Arizal did. 6 days, and then he would come home just for Shabbos. And when he came home just for Shabbos, he would only speak to his wife. And not only did he only speak to his wife, but he only spoke Hebrew. This is a well-documented thing that happened, that the Arizal did, that he only spoke to another person, and it was only one person, it was his wife, once a week, one day a week. The rest of the week he was learning by himself, literally on an island, secluded from the rest of the world. He did this for 6 years, apparently. 6 years. I don't know about the details. What did he do for Yantif? I don't know. Don't ask me these questions. Kids, I don't know. I don't know. You can't ask Casas on these kind of mices. But this is what happened. And basically, he learns through the 1560s. So at this point, he's 30 years old. Right? So he's 30 years old. When he gets to the age of 36, different versions of the story, but Eliyahu HaNavi comes to him, or the Radvaz comes to him, and says, you got to go to Eretz Yisrael. Okay. Why do I have to go to Eretz Yisrael? First of all, he was born there. He had left there. But why do I have to go to Eretz Yisrael? He says there's a group of rabbis in Sfat that are very Kabbalistically inclined. You've learned all you can by yourself here. You have to go learn in Sfat. And you have to teach them everything that you've learned. Now, the Arizal was not happy about this. because the Arizal liked that he was learning by himself in seclusion, and you know, he was having conversations with Eliyahu HaNavi and things like that, and he thought he was getting a lot of, you know, heavy stuff in the Kabbalah, and the Radvaz or Eliyahu HaNavi encourages him. He says, you know, when you go to Eretz Yisrael, when you go to Tzfat, it won't just be that you'll be able to give over to other people what you've already learned, but it's also going to be that as we say, Eretz Yisrael, Avir de Eretz Yisrael Machkim, that the land of Eretz Yisrael allows you to learn better. And Eliyahu HaNavi says, the legend is, Eliyahu HaNavi says to the Arizal, if you go there, I can teach you things I'm not allowed to teach you in Chutz Laaretz. Right? Only in Eretz Yisrael can you learn these things. So that's what pushed the Arizal over the edge and said, okay, I'm going to Eretz Yisrael. So how old was he now? He's 36 years old. 1569 or 1570. He goes to Eretz Yisrael. Some people say he probably stopped off in Yerushalayim, because we find another thing from the Kairo Geniza that says that he gave this speech and it's in Yerushalayim. There are characters, Rabbi Kleinemus that lived there in Yerushalayim. So people think that he stopped off in Yerushalayim because of that, but it's unclear if he actually did. He makes his way, as you can imagine, to none other than Safed, to Tzfat. And in Tzfat, there's already a growing population of Kabbalistically inclined rabbis. So who are the rabbis that are already there? Anyone want to guess? Rav Yosef Karo is there, that's right. Anyone else?
Radak.
Not the Radak, but the Ramak. Okay. Who was the Ramak? Rabbi Moshe Cordovero. Rabbi Moshe Cordovero was, at that time, the lead Kabbalan in the world. He was the leading Kabbalist. People didn't know the Arizal yet, because he was by himself on an island for 6 years. But the Moshe Cordovero was basically the leader of Kabbalah in everywhere in the world, and he had written many books to explain the Zohar. No, he didn't write Derech Shem. That's the Ramchal. That's someone else that comes later, also Kabbalistically inclined. That's the 17th century. That's later. But the Ramak, Rav Moshe Cordovero, writes a couple books that help understand the Zohar. He writes a book called Pardes Rimonim, which goes through in a more systematic way the concepts of Kabbalah. And he writes other books as well that I can't remember off the top of my head. But he writes a couple books that are very helpful for Kabbalah. And the Arizal goes to Rav Moshe Cordovero, and he becomes a Talmud of Rav Moshe Cordovero. Unfortunately, Rav Moshe Cordovero dies within a few months of him getting there. Some people say it was as much as 18 months. It would seem to me that it was about 6 months. But I'm not really an expert. Either way, very short time. But on Rav Moshe Cordovero's deathbed, so he's basically surrounded by all these Kabbalanim, right? People that are masters in Kabbalah. So who's there? So you got Rav Moshe, you have Rav Yosef Karo, you've got Rav Chaim Vital, you have, let's see who else, Rav Yaakov Beirav. You know Rav Yaakov Beirav. He tried to reinstitute Tzmicha. He was that one, the Sanhedrin. You have Rav Moshe Alshech. You have Rav Shlomo Alkabetz. People know Rav Shlomo Alkabetz, right? What did he write? L'chadodi, right? If you read the acronym of L'chadodi, it's Shlomo Halevi. That's Rav Shlomo Alkabetz, who writes L'chadodi. So all these people are here. And then you've got the Arizal, 36-year-old Rav Yitzchak Luria, who just got there off the boat 6 months ago. And Rav Moshe Cordovero basically tells them, he's going to be my successor, the Arizal. And as you can imagine, people at first are very surprised. They're very taken aback. This guy, he just got here. We don't even know him from a hole in the wall. And he's going to be this successor. So basically, there's a legend that happens that Rav Moshe Cordovero tells them that one of you will be able to find the sign which shows where I'm supposed to be buried. And the only person that saw it was the Arizal. That's one way that the story goes. Either way, the Arizal becomes the successor of Rav Moshe Cordovero and basically takes over the mantle of Kabbalah. Right? You just inherited the throne. I mean, there are not many followers, but of this, you know, master's group, so he becomes the leader. And very soon, Rav Chaim Vital realizes that he's very much the rightful leader. And Rav Chaim Vital becomes his main student. He happens to be a few years younger than him anyways. But Rav Chaim Vital becomes his student. And what happens basically is that Arizal is tasked with giving over not only Rav Moshe Cordovero's Kabbalah, but also his own mysticism. He's trying to teach it over, and legends say that the Arizal had a very difficult time giving over Kabbalah. Not only did he not want to do it, as we saw from the story before, but he would say things like, I can't verbalize the concepts that I've been taught. He says one time, he was asked by his student to teach, and he says, like he woke up and he had some kind of conversation with Eliyahu HaNavi, and he wakes up and they say, "What did he teach you?" And he says, "If I had 80 more years to learn to live, I wouldn't be able to teach you everything he just told me in one night." That's what he says to his Talmidim. He says another time, he says, "If the entire ocean was just ink, that wouldn't be enough to teach you everything I've learned." So this is the struggles of the Arizal, you know, to give over Kabbalah. And beyond that, beyond the difficulty in giving it over, the Arizal told his Talmidim, "You're not allowed to write it down. You're not allowed to write it down." This comes from other halachic sources, but he says to them, basically, Kabbalah is something very precious, and it's something very sacred, and it can't just be given over to the masses, right? We've seen with our own eyes what has happened when you give it over to the masses. So the Arizal says to them, this is something that has to be transmitted by word of mouth. Unfortunately, what ends up happening is, first of all, the Arizal only lives in Sfat for about 2 to 2.5 years. He dies in 1572 from the bubonic plague, and Rav Chaim Vital is basically left afterwards to try to pick up the pieces. The Arizal didn't leave any works. He left one work, which was a very esoteric work that he wrote while he was in seclusion that we still have. But other than that, all the Kabbalah that he was supposed to give over, we didn't have much of it. So the Rav Chaim Vital was tasked in trying to maintain the traditions of the Arizal. And even Rav Chaim Vital knew he wasn't supposed to write it down. But what ultimately happened was other students started to write the Kabbalah of the Arizal, but they would write it wrong. And they were giving over false claims about the Kabbalah of the Arizal. So Rav Chaim Vital said, not necessarily, I don't know. But Rav Chaim Vital basically says, I have to set the record straight. I have to write down my rabbi's teachings so that it can be given over properly, so that people can understand what the true Kabbalah is. And that's what he ultimately does. And much of Lurianic Kabbalah that we know today is because of Rav Chaim Vital writing down the ideas of the Arizal. And they say that before he died, the Arizal, not so mysteriously, had 3 days earlier paid back all the debt he needed to pay. He paid all of his debts off, he settled all of his accounts, and then 3 days later, he passed away. Actually, tonight is his yahrzeit. Hey Av, the 5th of Av. So that's why we're learning about the Arizal. So the Arizal passes away in 1572. What is the acronym Arizal? What does it stand for? Does anyone know? Does anyone know what usually when we have a rabbi and he has an acronym, it starts with the letter Resh. Because rabbi, or maybe a mem, Morenu. But what does an Aleph stand for? Not Adonenu, that scares me. But it sounds even more scary. Not Admor, that's later in Chassidus. It actually stands for one of two things. Some people say it stands for Ashkenazi. Ooh. Because when he moved to the Sephardic Cairo, they had to demarcate as where he came from. It was something that people did back then. But probably the more relevant term is Eloki. Eloki means divine. Right? So there's mefilah, it's probably okay to say Elohi, because it's not referring to God, but some people say Elohi. So Elohi, Rabbi Yitzchak Zal, Arizal. Elohi, Rabbi Yitzchak, Zichrono Levracha. The divine Rabbi Yitzchak, may his memory be a blessing. That's why it's called the Arizal. Some people call him just the Ari, without the Zal, which is where Nusach Ari comes from. We'll get to that in a second. But that's the Arizal. The legacy of the Arizal is very... Yeah?
When
did he get that acronym?
After him or during
the... I think afterwards. I'm not sure, but I would presume afterwards. I don't know if you picked up on this, but he died at the age of 38. And typically... And the who?
Rabbi Cordovero was 39. A lot of
them... Cordovero was 39? He was that young?
Yeah, so was...
The Ramchal was...
A lot of them died at 39.
The Ramchal was 39. I'm not sure about Rav Moshe Cordovero. We'd have to look that up. But the Arizal, so his legacy is very interesting because he brings basically Kabbalah to the masses. We'll get into many of his main points in a second. But the legacy of the Arizal today, obviously it's been taken advantage of in different directions. But perhaps there's no greater abuse of Lurianic Kabbalah then what happens to his concepts only 50 years after he passes away? Anyone know what I'm referring to? The 1650s, 1620s? Shabtai Tzvi. Who was Shabtai Tzvi? Shabtai Tzvi was probably a bipolar, depressive, really a crazy person. And they didn't know that at the time, so they thought he was some kind of prophet, because he would go days without eating and days without sleeping, and he would just be, you know. And then his friend Nathan of Gaza comes along, it's a little pishery, 20 years old, and says, "Hey, I think you're a Mashiach." And he says, "You know what? I think you're right. Let's go tell everybody." And they go around all of Europe telling people that Shabtai Tzvi is Mashiach. What do they use to convince people? Lurianic Kabbalah. They talk about concepts of what we're about to explain, and they use it as justification for doing really terrible things. At what they call in philosophy as antinomian behavior. Things that go against the Torah, go against laws. And they justify it in weird ways based on Kabbalah. What's interesting is that what saves Kabbalah, literally saves Kabbalah, is the Hasidic movement. Because the Ramcha, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Lutzato, who comes right after the Shabtai Tzvi movement, is basically banned from teaching Kabbalah. Wherever he goes or across Europe, eventually they tell him he can't teach Kabbalah anymore. And that's the only thing he wanted to do, was teach Kabbalah. He ends up moving to Eretz Yisrael and ultimately dying, him and his whole family, because he contracts a plague, which is only in the Middle East. And meanwhile, he had to leave all these European communities who wouldn't let him teach Kabbalah. But comes along the Baal Shem Tov and all the Hasidic movements, and they revive Kabbalah, but with a different kind of focus, with a focus which isn't messianic. Has messianic undertones, but they're never the Hasidic movements never claimed that Mashiach was already here or something like that. Leave personal opinions to the side. So basically, Hasidism really revives Kabbalah, and to such an extent that there are some in the non-Hasidic world that accuse other rabbis of being influenced by Kabbalah, and then therefore claim that they're followers of Shabtai Tzvi. Famous debate between Rabbi Yaakov Emden and Rabbi Yonatan Eibschitz. Rabbi Yaakov Emden claims that Rabbi Yonatan Eibschitz sent an amulet to a woman who was having difficulty giving birth, and inside the amulet had a certain phrase that was known to be Kabbalistic. And they claim that he was using it because he was a follower of Shabtai Tzvi. That's the extent of the drama that comes in the aftermath of Shabtai Tzvi, to the extent that you couldn't learn Kabbalah. It couldn't be taught because of what happened with Shabtai Tzvi. But Hasidus comes back and revives it. That debate is really at the beginning of Hasidus in the 1770s, so it really doesn't have as much of a difference from Hasidic perspective. But this Kabbalah that we're talking about. So first of all,
1770?
Yeah.
Is that right to 770?
No. That's an address. But for a different time. Maybe not even for a different time. It's more than an address. It's a donation amount.
Right.
It's a phone number. It's a lot of things. But no, different 1770. That's not even 70. That's just 770.
Right.
But so what is this Lurianic Kabbalah? So off the bat, I don't know. I really, as I said a couple weeks ago, beyond my pay grade. And when it comes to the main tenets, so I can teach you to them, I can reference them. I give you a little taste for what they are. Obviously, you see here on your sheets something that most people have seen before one way or another. These are called the 10 Sfirot. The Sfiros, which you'll see are 10, 10 circles, but the truth is that there's one in the middle that people like to add. That Dalet in the intersection of the top four, the top five, whatever, is represents Das. That's where Chabad comes from, Chachma, Bina, and Das. Mm-hmm. I don't understand any of these things. But the way that I was explained to me, maybe some people here know it better, but we're not going to get into a whole discussion about it, that the Sfiros are basically the filtering of Hashem's presence into the world. So when it comes to Hashem's presence, when Hashem created the world, and this, by the way, differs from Rav Moshe Cordovero. This is a very big difference from Rav Moshe Cordovero. This is Lurianic Kabbalah's take on the creation of the world. First of all, there's a concept of Ein Sof, that God is, eternal, infinite. We can't understand it. There's nothing about our descriptions of Hashem that will fully encapsulate what Hashem is. So how has it come to be that Hashem, who is infinite, created a finite world? So he had to use a concept called Tzimtzum. Tzimtzum is the contraction of his spirituality, of his holiness, whatever it is. And the way that he brought it into a finite world is because he filtered it through these 10 levels of spheros. The way that Dr. Henry Abramson explained it was, you imagine looking at the sun. You can't really look at the sun. But if anyone here was part of the eclipse last summer in Kansas City, we were very close to the line, so many of us traveled and saw the full whatever. It was cloudy, so it didn't matter. But what did you have to do? So you had to put on special glasses. Or if you didn't have the special glasses, you'd use like this mirroring effect, right? Where you would put your head in a box or something like that, and there'd be a pinhole and a mirror, and you'd figure it out. Why do you have to do that? Because the sun's rays are too powerful. So you have to somehow filter it through a different process. You put it through here, and then you put it through there, and then you can see a semblance of the sun. Then you can look at it. But if you didn't, it'd be very dangerous. Threats of blindness and things like that. So he says, Lahavdil, of course, similar thing happens according to the Arizal at the time of creation. Hashem tries to contract his holiness, and he brings it through, but it's too much for the world to contain. And this is where the concept of Shivrei Kelim comes from.
Shviras
HaKelim, that all these different spheres create different vessels that can't hold Hashem's holiness. And as they filter through each of these levels, so there are more broken pieces and more broken pieces that are mixed up with the holiness of Hashem. Until you get all the way down to the bottom, to the Malchus, which is the bottom of the Sphiros, you get down to Malchus, that's Olam Hazeh. But by the time you come to Olam Hazeh, by the time it comes, all the holiness comes in, there are so many shards of the broken pieces of those containers that were broken by the holiness of Hashem that we've come to a physical world. That everything around us is physical, but it's mixed in with Hashem's what's called nitzotzos, the sparks of light that came through the shards that we are all now tasked to bring out of all the physicality in the world, right? So we have this table that if it was sold to somebody else, it would have been used for a boardroom table, or it would have been used for a dining room table, but now that it's in a shul, we're using it for shiurim, we're bringing out the nitzotzos of the physicality. This is made up of shards that were brought down in the world, and because it was mixed with certain holiness, so we're now releasing the holiness by doing mitzvos, by doing things with it that are of a holy endeavor, so we're releasing them. So this is one of the main concepts of Kabbalah that Hasidism uses a lot, and anyone who studies Kabbalah probably understands it at a very basic level. But this is one of the Arizal's main points, overarching concepts in Kabbalah. And oftentimes, if you read through Hasidic Svarim, you'll pick up every Parsha. There's another Hasidic Vart that goes through all these things. And when I see it, I just skip over because I have no idea what's going on. But he said, this thing represents Chesed, and this thing represents Hod, and this thing represents Tiferes. I have no idea what's flying. Everything represents a different thing. And really, it's beyond my pay grade. I don't understand any of it. And beyond that, the reason that we don't learn Kabbalah is because you're supposed to have a certain foundation to work with so that you could build Kabbalah on top of it. Now there are diluted forms of Kabbalah, which is really what Hasidus oftentimes is. But real Kabbalah is something that you can't really understand unless you have a full foundation of the regular Torah, what we call the Nigla, Torah HaNigla, things that are revealed to us. Kabbalah is referred to as Torah HaNistar. Obviously, there are differentiations and nuances to this concept, but we're not going to get into it, especially in Hasidic sects. They have different takes on that. But that's one of the main things of the Arizal, the Nitzotzos, the Tzimtzum, the Shivrei Kelim, and the Sphiros. There's another thing that people know the Ari for, which is the Nusach Ari. What is the Nusach Ari? The truth is that the Arizal didn't make the Nusach Ari. The Arizal happened to daven in a different way based on Kabbalistic sources, but the Nusach Ari was actually created, if I'm not mistaken,
By the Alter Rebbe,
by the Baal Tanya, by Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi. He apparently took 60 different manuscripts and compared and contrasted them, and through that was able to discern what exactly the Arizal said when he davened. And apparently he added other things to it also, but generally it's what the Arizal is purportedly said to have davened when he davened. I don't exactly know what point in time it was based on, because he was in seclusion for 6 years when he was learning the Kabbalah, and then he was in Tzvat for about 2 years, so maybe I guess during those 2 years they could discern from it.
I was taught that
yeah.
The Alter Rebbe wanted to make a prayer book that was stripped down of all, you know, a lot of prayers and poems and songs had been accumulating over the centuries, and he wanted to simplify the Siddur.
Okay.
So that it may make it a little bit more accessible.
That's probably another thing that he did with it. Yeah. So anyways, when you hear somebody davening a Nusach Ari, so that's something that was created by the Alter Rebbe. And in many ways, that sort of filtered into what's now called Nusach Sfard. I don't know why they called it Nusach Sfard and confused the entire Jewish world, but it has nothing to do with Sephardis. It's just Nusach Sfard, and it incorporates some of the changes of the Arizal. It's not a full Nusach Ari, obviously, or otherwise it would be called Nusach Ari, but Nusach Sfard takes in some of the changes from the Arizal. So that's another thing that he's known for. Another thing he's known for are Gilgulim, the concept of Gilgulim, which is...
Incarnations.
Is incarnations, but is really only out from the Zohar. And all of this is really the Arizal's take on the Zohar, which is really indiscernible unless you have some kind of handbook to understand it.
A few handbooks.
There are many. There are many different commentaries. And the Arizal is perhaps the most well-known for his explanations and his accessibility of the Zohar and of Kabbalah. As I said before, that's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, through history that has allowed us to understand concepts and even include within our own practices many Kabbalistic practices that we wouldn't have had without the Arizal's explanations. But beyond that, the other side of the sword is that it's been abused. We've seen through Shabtai Tzvi, we see it nowadays with sort of modern concepts of it, you know, that have adulterated the concepts of Kabbalah to be twisted and turned in one way or another without the foundations of Halacha, which was never supposed to be intended. So obviously it's a double-edged sword, but the Arizal's influence is seen no matter what, you know, corner of the earth you find yourself in, especially in Judaism, but even in secularism, in non-Jewish circles, even in irreligious Jewish circles. The concept of the Tikkun Olam is in many ways connected to the Arizal's concept of bringing the Nitzotzos out of the Shivrei Kelim. I forgot to mention that when you bring the Nitzotzos out of the Shivrei Kelim, so that's called the Tikkun, right? That's when we have, you know, Tikkuns in the morning or whatever it is. So it's along the same lines that we're creating some kind of merit, we're creating some kind of holiness through our actions. As we said before, it's a double-edged sword, but one thing's for sure, the Arizal's legacy has been absolutely more influential than most rabbis in history, and he did it all in 38 years, which is a muster unto itself, beyond all the lessons that he taught. It's a muster unto himself. So the last couple of pictures here, if you look at the top left, this is a bad copy of the Arizal's mikvah in Tzfat, down the hill. If anyone's been there, you know what I'm talking about. It's very cold, even in the summer, and you can go there and experience it for yourself. This right to the right of that is some artist's depiction of what the Arizal might have looked like. I doubt that that's actually what it looked like. Maybe this is based on another painting I don't know about. Beneath that is a very bad copy of the Arizal Shul in Tzfat that you can go see. And to the right is the hill in Tzfat where many of these Kabbalists are buried. You see the front left corner is the Ramak, Rav Moshe Cordovero. You see the top right corner is Rav Shlomo Alkabitz. I can't read the other ones, but where is the Arizal? He's right in the middle. If you see, there are a bunch of boxes around one tombstone behind the Rav Moshe Cordovero. That's the Arizal, perhaps the most crowded one throughout the year that people leave candles at, people leave stones at. So if you're ever there, and much of these are covered in blue, the Kabbalistic blue. My wife and I have an ongoing tally of different things that we have to do in order to get us to move to Israel. One of the things that we would have to do is to get a house with a blue door. The other, I don't know why, it's just one of her things. The other things we're not going to go into, so as to say it's not happening anytime soon. But either way, these kfarim are very much covered in this light blue. And if you go to Tzfat, light blue is all over the place. It represents the Shemayim and Kisei HaKavod and things like that, much like the Tcheles does. But these are just some of the little snippets of the Arizal's life. so that hopefully the next time you hear the Arizal did this, the Arizal did that, you'll at least appreciate who the Arizal was, the unbelievable sacrifices he made in order to maintain Kabbalah, in order to teach Kabbalah, and ultimately he did all of it within 38 years, which we can certainly learn from.
Isn't it true that for a long time nobody was allowed to go in there, and that
going where
into the Arizal's mikveh, and that for a long the people who tried to go in either didn't come out or they came out not.
I am not familiar with that.
Okay.
I don't know.
Either the Friedeke Rebbe or the Baba Sali opened it up.
Okay, not sure. But anyone who's interested in learning Kabbalah, I would discourage it unless you're learning it in very simple terms and you're learning it for intellectual whatever. We obviously still have this restriction to only learn once you're 40 and to only learn once you have a good basis in halacha and a basis in Torah and foundations. But suffice it to say that much of our halacha, not tons, but there are many halachas that we do nowadays which are influenced by the Arizal and his little group in Sfat, specifically Friday night davening.
You should do a plug for Daf Yomi so you can get to lead you on the way.
Okay. If you want that foundation, you can come learn Daf Yomi.
Start with Daf Yomi.
Okay. My Rebbe used to say that there are two types of people in the world. There are people that go to Olam Haba, and there are people that don't learn Daf Yomi. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what he said. Yeah, Leonard.
How do these 10 spheros relate to the 7 spheros that we talk about with Spheros Omer?
They are. They're the bottom 7, I think, right?
The bottom 7, yeah.
The bottom 7.
The emotional attributes.
The ones that are closer down, maybe the emotional ones. I have no idea. Yeah. But yeah, they are related. If you look at the 7 in the Spheros HaOmer, so you'll see all those 7 on the bottom, but not the top 3. Okay, Shkayach, thanks for coming.
Thank
you.
Yair
Chmiel.
I was just curious, what's the connection between the mikvah and the Ari themselves?
I think he made that mikvah. I think that, I don't know, maybe. You'd have to ask somebody else. I think that's what it is. Okay, have a good night.